You probably should get 3 points just for being here today.
Sounds good.
Sounds good, yeah? We'll see what we can do. All right. Okay. The review sessions are scheduled. I think those are the times that were most popular. And the first one will be after class a week from Wednesday. And the other one will be on Thursday at 4, but I don't have confirmation of the room yet. I will before that day, obviously. And I will put those on the web. I'll probably also send an email. And the exam, believe it or not, is a week from Friday here. And it will be at 11:45 a.m. In case you were reading the syllabus carefully, you might have thought that it was at 11:45 p.m. because that's what it said on the schedule. On the first page, it says 11:45 a.m., but I didn't get the change made on the inside on the schedule, so it says p.m. there. And I thought that in order to be fair, we should give it twice, but Talia has declined to proctor the one at 11:45 p.m., so we're not going to do that one. I'm sorry. If you feel cheated, just refer to the first page of the syllabus and take that as the right one. But anyway, it was fun to be reminded of that. Thank you, Adam, for pointing that out to me. And the format for the review sessions will be to answer any questions that you have, and then I will give you some practice exercises that we can do during the session to show you what sorts of things might be expected on the final. Tiffany. Good question. Take your chances. No, I'll try to have enough variety so that if you actually came to both, you might get something different. Or you'd get them right the second time. Yes. I will produce some study questions before next Monday for the readings to focus you on some of the things that I would be expecting you to have gotten from the reading. As far as how to prepare, no Bronfenbrenner. Be able to apply it. Be familiar with the readings. Get a good night's sleep the night before. Eat breakfast that day. Eat a snack just before the exam. Take a walk. Get fresh air. All that sort of stuff. When are you going to get your papers back? What? When they're done. Monday at the latest. And if Talia doesn't get enough sleep, Wednesday. That's pretty impressive. Yeah. But Wednesday at the latest. Yes.
Is the format of the exam pretty similar to the final?
Will the format for the final be similar to the eco exam? No, not really. I won't do the matching kind of stuff. I won't do the cross these out. It will be, there'll be a heavy slug of multiple choice, creative multiple choice questions. Creative on our part, not on your part. Creative on our part. and some short essay and a couple of exercises that will be similar to but not quite like the interpretations on the eco exam, but not the same style. And a couple of longer-ish essays, you know, half a page. Have I done anything else? No, that's basically it. Cumulative, yes, it covers everything. The final covers everything. Everything I have said, everything in the reading, everything in all the readings, everything in the Duval Ecology text. The whole thing. I don't know how many points it's worth because I'm not done.
Emily.
No, it's points. No. Everybody will pass it. Right? So everybody will pass it, and you will get the number of points that you got, and those will be added to all your other points, and then eventually we will do this long distribution, and I will go when I'm in a good mood. Talia's job is to make sure that I'm in a good mood when I assign the grades to the distribution. So and she does not take bribes during class. This is... yeah. I can't know anything about it. And just remember that all the academic honesty stuff that applies to undergraduates is even more stringent for graduate students because once they get thrown out, they can't get back in. Anywhere. So don't tempt her too much and don't sell yourself cheap. No, she really wants to be a counselor, so she wants to finish her graduate program. And she will. Other questions? Housekeeping stuff? Yes. They are points. Everything that has been assigned points is just added into your total. Thank you for the segue. Last week's exercises are here. 3 points. And that's what it was. How are the nurturing stage and the authority stage different? And why do some people have more difficulty with one than with the other? So what you would have needed to do for the 3 points is to discuss each of the two stages in some way that made it clear that you knew what the stages were about and then how they were different. And that's wide open. There are many different ways to describe the difference between the stages. So I didn't have any predetermined notion as I was reading about how you should describe those differences. Just should it should be something based on Galinsky and the lecture that day. And then for the second part, the question is, why do some people have more difficulty with one than with the other? So the point in that part of it is to think about, and Galinsky talks about it and I talked about it, why one or the other might be more difficult for a particular person. Not which stage is more difficult. Some of you tackled it that way, that in your view one was more difficult than the other because... That's not directly addressing, it may be true that you think that, and it might be valid, but it's not responsive to the question, which is why would some people have more difficulty with one than the other? And ideally your answer would have specified that a person could have difficulty with one, more than the other, or the reverse. It could have been the nurturing stage that was difficult for some people. Other people might have more difficulty in the authority stage. And you needed to pick at least one of those and offer some suggestions about why it might be more difficult. And you could address that, again, in a number of ways, either because of experience that the person had had, temperament, personality characteristics. Many of you mentioned that made it easier or harder to be nurturing in the giving kind of way that infants require. Or you could have talked about the difficulty that some people have in exercising authority in an appropriate way, or finding, some of you did say very nicely that for some it might be difficult to combine both the nurturing piece and the authority piece at the same time, which is a complex task. But some of us have more difficulty with it than others. So there are many different ways you could go. What I was looking for was that you answered the first part with a clear way the two stages are different, and that you answered the second part with something about the parental characteristics that would make the one stage more difficult than the other for a particular person. Nothing off for grammar or spelling. Because you didn't have your spell checker with you. These are the kinds of questions that would be on the essay part of the exam, particularly a short essay. Yeah. And one of the reasons that I've gone over these, at least in the last two, is to make sure that you have the opportunity to hear what I'm looking for in the way of responsiveness. And give you practice on the point of the exercise, many points of the exercises. One is to give me feedback. Two is to reward you for being here on a beautiful sunny day, or even a snowy day, whenever it was. But also to give you some experience with how we think when we start to read, when we figure out what we're looking for in a particular exam. But that kind of analysis of, okay, this question requires me to talk about both and how they're different. Then it requires me separately to talk about why a person might have more trouble with one than the other. So, yeah. And if you think that through on any essay question ever that you get in your life, you think, will you ever get any more? Yeah, you'll get more. If you do that exercise and think about what a grader would be looking, you'll be taking this, the question apart and looking at what the answers would be, what kinds of answers the grader would be looking for. That's a useful kind of skill in any situation. It's called careful reading and figuring out what would be responsive. One of the frustrating things for all graders of essay questions is the person who writes a perfectly nice essay, you know, well-constructed and good grammar and proper spelling and legible handwriting, but it doesn't address the question that was asked. I'll give you an example of one of my favorite students many, many years ago. And she still likes me, but she had to do a term paper for a particular course, and we gave the questions, the topics were assigned. Students could pick any one of a bunch of them. And she turned in this wonderful, wonderful paper. It was just absolutely perfect. And in the particular course, you either got an A on what you turned in or nothing. So it was a kind of stepwise assignment. And you could revise it until it became an A. And when I gave it back, she appeared in my office in tears and spent half an hour crying in my office because she thought it was an A paper because it was so well written and she had really answered. It was just And I had to agree with her, except that it was a two-part question, and she wrote a brilliant answer to the first part. Nothing on the second part. Didn't get it. And it turned out that she was more emotionally reactive to having it turned back for revision than otherwise might have been, because she had never in her life had anything given back. She'd never gotten anything less than an A on anything. And she had a very demanding father whom she was still trying to please. I stepped into his role and she was trying to please me. Please me by going and revise the question and the paper to include the other half. I saw her at a meeting last spring, a year ago, and she introduced me to people at the meeting as one of her two favorite professors at UVM, so we got over it. Dale was the other one, for those of you who know Dale. Okay, so you have to read carefully and make sure you address the question and write, then put it aside, then go back and read it again and make sure you've really addressed the question. But that's true in life generally, not just here. All right. Any other questions about the exam? Any other questions about the exercise? Okay. Then let's talk about the interdependent stage. And Galinsky. I had it. There it is. Now I can talk because I have my laser pointer. If I were 25 miles from home and had a tie on and a laser pointer, I'd be considered an expert and they'd pay me big money. All right. Puberty changes a child and forces change in all of the relations. That's what this stage is about. We're through the interpretive stage, although I think it's reasonable to say that we continue to interpret life and the world and ourselves and themselves to adolescence. But hopefully we've learned to do that. And now we're going on to accept gradually the changing image of the child who is now an adolescent becoming bigger and stronger and smarter and much more our equal. The thing that throws some of us, according to Galinsky, is that we have images about when puberty will take place, when people will become adolescents, and sometimes that's not accurate. Our images are not accurate, particularly if we get a particularly early maturing kid or a particularly late maturing adolescent. We may be off. I've probably told my story about my favorite experience of being an expert. When I first moved to the university, to Pittsburgh, to teach at the university there many years ago, our neighbors had three daughters, and two of them were close to adolescence. One was about 8 and the other one was 10. And then they had this baby girl. And the baby girl was probably the unhappiest, most fussy child I have ever lived next to in my life. She was just miserable. And one day the mom was complaining about how this baby, who was unexpected, was really a surprise, had ruined life for particularly the elder daughter, the eldest of the three. And it turned out this was an accidental baby, and the story was kind of cute. They had these two kids who were at that time 7 and 9. They weren't going to have any more, and so they gave away all the baby stuff and somebody came and took it and picked up a truck and it went away, and the mom realized a couple of weeks later that even as it drove away, she was pregnant. And so they had to go out and buy all new stuff for this baby. But the point of the story was that she was blaming this baby, who was fussy, for having ruined her relationship with the oldest daughter. And the evidence for the oldest daughter and her relationship was that the girl was being much more standoffish. She was being kind of private. She was spending more time to herself. She was more psychologically labile. She cried more, and she was picking fights with her mother and unhappy with herself. And mom was assuming that was all due to the baby and just disturbing the whole family. It was an interesting hypothesis, but my observation was that this kid was, just from observing her in the yard, that she was in the early stages of puberty. Long legs, long arms, hands and feet were getting bigger, and so I suggested to the mom that maybe it really wasn't the baby's fault, maybe it was puberty, since most of us get unpleasant as we go through puberty, at least for a period of time. And the mother, having an image of timing combined with an image that her kid wouldn't change, had missed her child's growth and what it meant. I got some pleasure out of the fact that mom had been a psychology major in college. Not child development, she'd been a psychology major, and of course they had only looked at rats. So I suggested to mom that she look closely and check to see if maybe there weren't some pubertal changes such as breast buds and pubic hair happening. And mom called me after bedtime, after the kids' bedtime that night, and said, "How did you know that?" And she thought I was the dirty old man next door who was spying on her daughter, but I wasn't. Said, "Well, what you described was fairly typical." And then mom started protesting, said, "She can't be. She's only 10. She's not a teenager yet." The image that mom had of timing was that you go through puberty when you become a teenager, 13. That would be late. That would be late in our culture, especially among upper middle class kids. So after some discussion, I assured her that her daughter was probably perfectly normal, and if she went back to her own puberty, she might realize that she had, and she realized that she had menstruated at 12, and her daughter was following a similar pattern. So the image that the mother had of timing was keeping her from recognizing what was going on in her daughter, and the scapegoat was the poor six-month-old who was being blamed for everything in the family at that point. I'm happy to report that that child actually grew up normal. She just was one of those really fussy, I'm unhappy babies. Maybe because her parents didn't want her. I don't know. But anyway, she's fine now. And the problem that many of us have is that our kids won't change. We've just gotten used to this wonderful elementary school kid who's so responsible and so curious and doing so well in school and all of those other things, and then we get a pubescent kid. So that's a challenge. We see the new kids, the new adolescents' potentials and skills change. They begin to be formal operational. They begin to think abstractly. They begin to be curious. They begin to challenge our thinking. That's the problem for most of us. And that changes the transactions we have with parents. And parents are looking at that and realizing, some of us, that our kids are going to be prettier than we are, more attractive than we are, bigger than we are, more powerful than we are. They're going to be smarter than we are. And they're going to have opportunities that we couldn't have dreamed of. No envy in that. Right? Of course we're envious of what our kids are going to become. And so some parents have difficulty accepting that their kids are going to be superior. So some of you perhaps had parents who began to be a little more demanding, a little more critical, a little more committed to trying to make sure that you were one down, so that you wouldn't get too big for your britches, you wouldn't get a swelled head. They needed to put you in your place occasionally. And that's often fueled by the envy that we have and the fear that adults have that the kids are actually going to be better than we are in every way, and how are we going to possibly maintain your respect if you're smarter than we are. If you're a smart parent, you look at your kid and say, the fact that the kid is going to be smarter and more attractive and have more opportunities than I had is a sign of my success as a parent. Right? That's what it means. And if you take that perspective, then you can just sit back and say, yeah, okay, go for it. And you have to remind everybody that you did a great job as a parent, which is actually what everybody else is thinking when your kid is successful. You must have done something right. But parents have a difficult time accepting that as the cause of their kids being so good. We get to negotiate toward more equal power and reciprocity with the kid. And that is a negotiation, and it's driven by the child. And some of us have difficulty negotiating toward greater reciprocity. It's difficult for us to change the rules for the kid. It's difficult for us to back up and back off as the kid demonstrates that he or she is competent, is trustworthy, is going to manage his or her own life, whether we like it or not. It's hard for us to celebrate that and to give up the parental authority, which we've enjoyed because we're older and we think better and we're bigger. And then we don't stop being older, but we stop being smarter and we stop being bigger. So we have to negotiate. At the same time, the authority that we can exercise differs, changes, and the adolescent is spending more time with other adults. And that's been gradually happening, but if you look at the kids' involvement in outside activities, eventually they'll be getting jobs. They'll be going on trips with other people. They'll be spending much more time with teachers, with other people's parents, with coaches. We begin to see our involvement in their mesosystem reduced. So we have less knowledge of what's going on in their lives, and that makes it harder for us to provide counsel and advice and guidance and safety for the kid. It's harder for us to direct what's going on in their lives. Kids are in settings with less parental and other adult involvement, and that's difficult. Kids are involved in problems that have two kinds of problems. One is problems that we also have. That's an issue. And the second kind is the problems that we don't understand. Either they're new problems because we didn't have to deal with them. Talk to your parents about how they dealt with, or how their parents dealt with their internet usage. Right? And chat rooms and Facebook and MySpace and pornography on the internet. Your parents didn't have to deal with it in their adolescent years because it wasn't there. Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet. So we understand the problems less well. In a previous generation, mine, for example, alcohol was present and we had to learn to deal with that, but none of the other drugs were available where I grew up except marijuana, and I didn't know about that. So we didn't have to deal with it. Raising my kids, you know, everything available, everything imaginable was available, and we had to help them try to figure out how they were going to cope with the fact that it was much more ubiquitous for them. Galinsky describes two major issues that parents wrestle with. One is communication, maintaining it and maintaining it with positive affect when the content of the communication is often much more challenging. And when the adolescent's communication skills are so much better than they were when the adolescent was a child. So as kids become formal operational reasoners, their communication skills get much better, and the stuff that they're communicating about is much more complex. So they often reach a level where it's difficult for us to express our viewpoints and our positions in a way that they can accept, whether they agree with them or not, just a way that they can understand. And setting limits and giving guidance. When kids are involved in activities that we're not involved in and we don't have any control over, it's hard to set limits. When kids are perfectly capable of sneaking out the upstairs window or using their cell phone to tell us that they're someplace where, in fact, they're not, or all of the other ways you challenged your parents during adolescence, it's harder for us to know what's going on and to set limits. It's harder to find appropriate ways to enforce limits when they are violated. There's less intersetting knowledge that's related to the kid having a broader and less connected mesosystem. So there's less that we can know about it. And we're less likely to know the people who are in charge of the settings that our kids are involved in during adolescence. You still have the challenge of trying to avoid the power struggles. Again, with adolescents, you can't win them. You couldn't win them with two-year-olds. You can't win them with adolescents. So you avoid them. That doesn't mean you avoid authority and limits and guidance and expectations. It means that you don't let those turn into power struggles. And that requires a thoughtful approach to what you're trying to do. One of the issues that Galinsky talks about is the difficulty that the kid's changes as the adolescent is becoming an adult coincide with the parents' changes as we leave the childbearing years, as we deal with being middle-aged or beyond. And then for some of you and for some parents and adolescents, adolescence coincides with our own re-entry into adolescence, which comes about if we divorce. And some of you have had the experience of having your parents being in the dating scene while you're in the dating scene and trying to advise you while they're asking you for advice about what it is they ought to be doing. One of the classics is as kids get into typically late high school, sometimes it's early college, the parent has a boyfriend, girlfriend, who stays over, and that can be difficult for the adolescent. And then the adolescent wants to have his or her significant other stay over, and the parent insists that that will not happen, and there you are faced with the imbalance, the inequality, the non-reciprocity of that situation, where the parent is entertaining a significant other overnight in your house, and the adolescent is being told, you can't do that. It requires some delicate negotiation and a pretty good understanding of the situation to be able to stick to your guns on that on the basis of generational difference. And to be able to, and many people don't do this successfully, they end up caving. But the difference is that the parental generation pays the rent, owns the house, whatever, and is the parental generation. And there are some perks that go with that, some privileges that go with that. then you just have to explain your hypocrisy and why your relationship is different than the kids' relationship and the reputation issue and all of that sort of stuff. And the deeper you go into that, the more likely you are to eventually end up with egg on your face and a kid throwing it back in your face someday that the relationship that has just fallen apart for you was the one that you said was much more permanent and committed and adult than the one that he has with his girlfriend, and you lose. But that becomes difficult for parents and certainly affects the negotiation process that's going on as you're trying to keep your kid from growing up too fast in the face of the fact that you're trying to go back and grow up, having been through a divorce. What happens with dating, going back to just what's happening with the adolescent, is that for many of us it's difficult to accept our kids as potential mates for other people, and they're bringing these interesting people into the microsystem, or they're not bringing them into the microsystem. And either way, it creates a challenge for us. If your child is dating somebody who's involved with your child but not with you, you're left with this lack of information and rising fear for many of us about what's really happening. And then if the kid does bring them home, as many of us insist, you don't date anybody for very long that we don't meet, then you have to figure out how to incorporate them into your microsystem. What are the limits of that? When do you go home? Who's in charge of the household? Can you have your significant other over any time so that you end up feeding this other family's child, which can get expensive? You know, they sometimes eat a lot of food. Can you predict it? Does it have to be scheduled? There's a whole negotiation around the pattern of involvement of the significant others of the adolescent in the household. And for some of us, that's difficult. Some of us have had open doors anyway, and we've had all the neighborhood kids in, and they're there, and they know how to behave in our house. And we're considered the cool parents because we do encourage our children's friends to be there. Others of us have not had that happen. So when somebody comes, an outsider comes into the household, for example, for dinner, this is a big deal. And families can have patterns that are very open to that, where it's a very informal system that anybody who's around at dinner time gets fed, or they can be at the other end of the spectrum and say, you have to have a reservation, we have to know you're coming 2 days in advance, and then we're all going to be stiff and formal and not know how to talk to you because we're not used to doing that. So there we are as parents trying to figure out what our pattern is, and there we have our kids wishing that we had a different pattern or enjoying the fact that their friends are welcome into the household. How many kids do we take on vacation with us? When does a significant other get to go to Florida for the week? And where does she sleep when that happens? These are all negotiations that are going to take place. There's an impact during this stage on the parental relationship. What happens to the parents, assuming there are two of them and they're still around? Later hours. The adolescent is out there, and just about the time you'd like to go to bed is when you start realizing that it's an hour and a half till curfew, and you get to start worrying. And for many parents, it's staying awake and worrying or not sleeping well until the chicks are safely tucked in their beds, which on Saturday nights may be fairly late. So parents find themselves getting cranky because they're not getting enough sleep. Or one of them is staying awake and the other one is peacefully slumbering on, And then they fight about that. You're not a good parent. You don't worry about our son. Now, it's not that I'm not worrying. I'm just sleeping. There's no point staying awake while you worry and losing sleep. Why not just go to sleep? Then the parents get into conflict about how they're supposed to manage this. And some parents will get frustrated with a spouse, the other parent, who's staying awake and worrying and wanting to check up. And the parent is saying, forget it, just relax, go to sleep. Don't worry about it. She's fine. And then they get into a conflict about how they're managing their concern. So the parental relationship is affected by adolescence in a way that it was not affected during the interpretive stage. It may be difficult to find time to be alone. Adolescents stay up later than their parents. So parents may find it difficult to find that alone time when they can nurture their relationship because they know somebody else is awake in the house and it's a child who would certainly be mortified if he or she heard noises from the parents' bedroom that suggested that the parents were engaging in behaviors that the kids don't ever want to think about their kids engaging in, even when they get to college. You don't want to think about your parents being adults in a loving relationship having sex. So the adults have to figure out how to deal with that and can actually be quite happy when kids turn their stereos up too loud or the television. And may encourage that because it masks whatever the parents are doing when they take time out. Identity. The teenager is creating his or her own image of him or herself. Image making. But this is an image of the teenager, the adolescent, that is being created by him or herself based on his or her role experimentation, if you follow Erikson, and defining himself or herself to the world in ways that may not be compatible with the parents' image. What they would like their child to project to the world may be exactly what the child is going to resist projecting to the world. My parents want me to be X, Y, or Z, therefore, I'm going to be D, E, and F. Very different from what my parents want. And the experimentation and self-definition that adolescents go through is often, at least in part, carefully designed to tweak the parents. None of you did that, right? None of you ever did anything that would make your parents concerned about their reputation or the family reputation. Who's got the wonderfulest example of something that was designed to make your parents nervous?
I have a short house an hour away from where my parents live. So I basically have a house to myself. And I think I would go there every weekend and live there during the summer. And of course, I have parties. And as soon as I have one time that things escalated and one kid poured a bottle of Everclear over another and lit him on fire.
I need one piece of information. I'm not familiar with Everclear.
Everclear is a pure green alcohol. It's 180 proof. You shouldn't drink it. You shouldn't drink it before a fire.
It sounds like lab alcohol. Okay. So, and what happened to the recipient of the alcohol?
He had third-degree burns.
Third-degree burns, uh-huh. Yeah. And your neighbors were real happy about that, and your parents. Okay. Any of the others disappoint your parents somewhere along the line? Leave the private high school for the public one? mortifying, especially if they lost that second semester tuition. Yeah. That one hits close to home. My son left a prep school at the end of the first semester. We were obligated for the whole year. It's all right, Kiff. I love you. Yeah. We had some of those. And because you knew your parents wouldn't like them, you really talked up the relationship with your parents and put a ring on and, oh, this is nothing. Don't worry about it. Right. I think one of my favorites was, speaking of that same son, whom I love dearly, in high school he went through a period of wearing a lot of leather and stuff, and it went along with the thin, and he has Irish heritage. I don't, but he does through his mother. So we love Irish music. So one St. Patrick's Day, I got tickets to the Flynn. I've forgotten which Irish group was playing, but we went to dinner at Sweetwater's, which is one of his favorite restaurants, and I had come from wherever. So there we were, and I was wearing a blue blazer and a tie, you know, one of those nice, preppy things, with my usual haircut, short on top. And he arrived with his own transportation, and he had done the leather to the nines. The fin was green, and it was just beautiful. You know, it was about 6 inches, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful job. And that's all there was. The rest was skin. So there we are sitting at Sweetwater's, the blue blazer and the green fin, and we're talking about food and the proper creation of French onion soup, and what bread goes best with French onion soup, and we're doing that. And then we went to the Flynn, and I made sure that he sat on the aisle so that I could sit next to him, turn toward him while we talk, and watch people come down the aisle. So I was watching people come down the aisle, enjoying this. I didn't have an adolescence, you see. So I had mine in his by watching him as vicarious pleasure. And as we left the Flynn, he paid me one of the highest compliments. He said, "Dad, I really have to hand it to you." "Oh, thank you. What is it?" I thought maybe he had a dirty Kleenex or something. And there aren't a lot of fathers who could go out with somebody who looks as outrageous as I do and be perfectly comfortable. You get to define yourself. You know? I told him, you've always liked costume. I think it's pretty cool. And if I said anything about the fin, it would have to be based on envy. Can you imagine the fin that I could grow? Yeah. Okay. So anyway, that was my favorite. And that was just about as far as he could possibly go. The dreads, a couple of years later, the fin was best, especially green. His own image and interpreting herself to the family and to the world, often, at least for a time during adolescence, in contrast to what the family presents to the world as the image of this family. Galinsky doesn't talk about that I recall from the book. But think about the fact that parents are also creating an image of the family to present to the world. And during adolescence, the adolescent is changing that image, is tinkering with that image, and calling into question whatever image the adolescent has presented to the world. Okay, why is this the interdependent stage? Why does she call this interdependent? What does interdependent mean? You know what depend means? It's a brand name. No, that's something else. Depend means to hang from. To hang down from. When we are dependent on somebody else, we are suspended from them. We need them. What happens if they're not there or they're not dependable? We fall. So dependent means that you are suspended from and rely on whoever and whatever it is that you are dependent on. Where we tend to think we are going is to become independent, not relying on. So if you're independent, instead of hanging from, you're down on the ground standing on your own too. That's a much safer place to be because you don't depend on somebody else or depend from someone else. So the independence is not having to rely on anybody else. Interdependent is where we get to interdependent upon my dictionary for spelling. Let's put another syllable in there. Interdependent means that we rely on each other and we are able to rely on, we are each suspended from the other. Another way to think of it is that if we think about a telephone pole being independent, it stands on its own. If we think about interdependence, we're creating a structure in which two relatively equal entities lean on each other. And as it turns out, if you watch the telephone poles being put up and watch them over the years, the ones that are joint, where they lean on each other, last a lot longer. It's a more stable structure to be interdependent. But it requires, interdependence requires the relative equality of the two entities, or three or four, how many ever are in your group, reciprocity. They are each depending on the other. And that is why Galinsky uses the term interdependence, because we're thinking about the adolescent and the parent as more equal, each contributing to the relationship and the relationship depending on the initiation of each person. The adolescent has the ability to withdraw completely from the relationship with the parent. Some of you did that. You can decide not to talk. You can decide not to share anything with your parent. In order for the transaction to continue and the relationship to continue to develop, both parties now have a responsibility to contribute to it. Both parties now have the responsibility or the task or the challenge of being able to come to understand the other person's viewpoint and negotiate from positions of relative equality toward a relationship that works. So it's interdependent in recognition of the fact that the adolescent has his or her own life outside the family. That's increasing and is moving increasingly in that direction. That what happens in the parent-adolescent relationship is dependent on the willing contribution of the adolescent to defining that relationship. And it's interdependent because the adult has to accept that. the adult has to accept that this person is able and has the power to determine what happens in the parent-child relationship. May not be able to take care of his or her own finances, may not be able to be on his or her own yet, but can determine what that relationship with the parent is going to be, and can make it hell if he or she wants to, or can abandon it. Codependent, I threw up there because it's often misused. People are sometimes talking about codependence as being dependent on each other, but that's not the way it's defined. It comes from drug and alcohol use, and we talk about being dependent on alcohol as an example, meaning we have an addiction, and the codependent the person who is codependent is not addicted to the alcohol, but is dependent on the addict continuing to be dependent. So as the codependent, I'm not addicted like the dependent person is, but I rely on the continuation of that person's dependency. In other words, I get some benefit from having this person continue to be dependent on whatever he or she's addicted to. Phyla? It's more than being enabling. The question for those of you listening was, could I give an example of being codependent? Sure. If you're addicted and I'm your partner, I get a lot of respect and admiration from other people for taking care of you, which makes me both an enabler and a codependent. And those are different. A codependent is often a really strong enabler, but you can be an enabler without being codependent. Yeah. I can encourage or I can support your addiction without really needing you to be addicted. But a codependent really needs for you to do that, and therefore will enable because you're getting that extra benefit. A codependent may feel like a martyr and feel really, really good about it himself because he's saddled with this person who is dependent and has so many problems. But if he didn't have the person who was dependent, then the codependent has no reason to live. We need you. That close enough?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. For many people who are in the codependent position, they don't know how to be a partner to somebody who is not focused on the addiction. If the person were actually focused on them, they would fall apart. It would be too stressful. Right. Yeah. It's being addicted to the other person's addiction. So you got to withdraw from it. Find other ways to support yourself and your self-image and get your goodies in the world. Because otherwise you're going to fall apart when the person who's addicted stops and discovers that, not only doesn't need the alcohol anymore, probably doesn't need you anymore. It helps to explain the resistance that significant others put up to a person trying to withdraw from an addiction. Okay, then Galinsky takes us to the departure stage. Get rid of them. Send them off to college. Marry them off to somebody else. I may have said this before, but I was honored by my niece who asked me to walk her down the aisle this summer at her wedding. And I'm very happy to do that, very proud to do that. And somebody said, oh, you're going to give your niece away. And I said, no, I'm not going to give her away. I'm going to share her with her fiancé, who will become her husband. I'm not going to give her away. She's still mine. I will share her. But in the wedding tradition, giving away is often the way we interpret that. Who gives this woman to be married? Her mother and I. Somehow reminds me of slavery, but we're not going there. Okay. How do you do that? You have to prepare for the departure. Some people are not. Some of you have the experience of having your parents bring you to college and expecting your mother to fall apart and start to cry, helping you set up your room, and were very surprised to discover it was your father who was crying because he sort of hadn't prepared for this event. Then they have to adjust their images of it when it happens. Redefine their identities as parents with grown-up children. And figuring out whether we did a good job or not. And we continue to do that for as long as our kids are alive. Every time our kids have problems, we figure it's our fault. We worry about them. So the departure stage is getting rid of them, but it's also then dealing with the aftermath of that. Some of the issues Galinsky talks about are the early departure. Sometimes kids leave home long before we expect them to. Sometimes they don't leave home when we want them to. So there we are with an image that isn't being fulfilled. When they do depart, we have to deal with the empty nest. What do we do now? Kids aren't here to entertain us. We have to entertain ourselves. The literature is very clear that women do not have problems with the empty nest if they have anything else in their life to look forward to other than being caregivers for their children. Most of them are happy to see their children go and happy to have them come home for the weekend, but don't stay too long, because we have other stuff to do. And many of you have already found out, or will if you haven't, that you don't know where your parents are. Some of you have that, right? You call, they're not there. Cell phones are great because they can return your call from wherever. But you don't know where they are. They have all their friends. They have too many things scheduled. They don't have time for you. And that can be a problem for you. But they've been just waiting for you to get out so that can happen. They have a whole list of things to do when the last one leaves. Parents sometimes have to deal with the fact that we launched them, but it was the shuttle. It keeps coming back. And what we turned into the sewing room now has to become the bedroom again because the kid comes back. We wrestle with kids who go out there on their own and sow wild oats, or the late bloomers, as she calls them. Kids who go out there, but they're not really on their own. They're not comfortable, and we worry about them until they get it together sometime in their early 30s. Then they have significant others that become really important and give us grandchildren and all of those things, and we have the sons and daughters-in-law. And then we deal with divorces. The kid we hoped wouldn't get married did, and then got divorced, and we get them back, sometimes with an affirmation that we were right. They were too young, but more often with just an acknowledgement that they need us, at least for a little while. I suggested you ought to get 3 points for being here on a sunny day. So let's give you the possibility of 3 points. Just pass them straight back. And the question is, okay, straightforward. Describe 2 changes in the parent-child relationship during the interdependent stage.